open a book and it invites you to fall in.
That was my North Star. I always sailed towards that star.
I meet them as grandmothers, but they go back to their villages as tigers.
Welcome to the National Writer Series on Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. Photojournalist Paola Gianturco says talking with grandmothers has made her realize there is hope in even the most seemingly hopeless situations.
And I said, oh my God, there is so much sorrow here. What do you say to help each other? And finally, one grandmother said, we say God is helping us because we are here to take care of the children.
Paola Gianturco's work with women has taken her around the world, documenting their struggles and success stories. Her latest book, Grandmother Power, A Global Phenomenon, profiles activist grandmothers from 15 countries across 5 continents. The women in her books tell their stories in their own words, accompanied by her photographs. And later this hour, fellow photographer Tony Demon will talk to Gianturco about her work. And we'll hear also from Jackson Kaguri, founder of the Nyaka AIDS Orphan Project. Here's Paola Gianturco with her presentation on grandmothers who are making a difference in their communities.
How many of you are grandmothers? How many of you know a grandmother? Everybody. All over the world, grandmothers are creating a better future for their grandchildren and yours and mine. I first began meeting them when I was working in rural Kenya, and I was sitting in a circle of women, and just to make conversation before I began working with them, I said, how many children do you have? And the first one said, I have 5 and 10 adopted. And the next one said, I have 6 and 15 adopted. And the next one said, I have 4 and 12 adopted. And suddenly, as I was listening to this routinized way in which they were answering, I realized that what they were really telling me was that they were raising their grandchildren who had been orphaned by AIDS. So much sadness. That year, as I worked all over the continent of Africa, I found grandmothers who were raising their grandchildren who had been orphaned by AIDS. I left thinking, the future of this continent rests in the hands of the grandmothers. I'm a grandmother too, just like many of you. I came back to the United States and did some research because I wondered what grandmothers were doing other places. And very quickly, I found grandmother groups, activist grandmother groups, in more than 30 countries. Unbeknownst to almost anybody, including me at that point, there is underway an international grandmothers movement. These are women who look around at our troubled world and say, not good enough for my grandchildren, and get to work. Ultimately, I went all over the world. I interviewed and photographed 120 grandmothers in 17 grandmother groups in 15 countries, in the Middle East, in Africa, in Asia, in Latin America, in the United States. They invited me into their homes. They introduced me to their children. Sometimes we danced. Sometimes they dressed me up in their saris because if I was wearing a black t-shirt, they didn't think that was anywhere nearly as bright and fun as grandmothers should be wearing. Learned a lesson. I met these women as my sisters, but by the time I finished this project, they were my heroes. So I want to introduce you to some of my heroes tonight, starting with grandmothers in India who have learned how to be solar engineers. 1 in every 5 people in the world lives without electricity. 200 Indian illiterate grandmothers began to study engineering, solar engineering, at the Barefoot College in Rajasthan, India. When they returned to their villages and brought electricity, everything changed. Midwives could see to deliver babies in the middle of the night. Children no longer got lung diseases from studying by kerosene lanterns. Those grandmothers returned to the Barefoot College to teach other Indian grandmothers how to do this special skill. Wanting to encourage the use of solar electricity all over the world, the United Nations began sending grandmothers from many countries to study with the Indian grandmothers. I was there when 20 grandmothers from Africa, two each from 10 countries, arrived in Rajasthan to study with the Indian grandmothers. Now I ask you, if you were an Indian grandmother, exactly how would you teach somebody who spoke a completely different language? In fact, many different languages. If you were an Indian grandmother, you would teach by color coding and experimentation and demonstration and gestures. Solar grandmothers have electrified households in 77 countries. 77 countries in the Middle East and Africa, Asia, and Latin America. Solar electricity now charges cell phones so they can do electronic banking. And it powers refrigerators, which they'd never had before at all. The solar grandmothers are viewed as VIPs. The man who runs the Barefoot College said to me, "I meet them as grandmothers, but they go back to their villages as tigers." Grandmothers are ending female genital mutilation in Senegal. Grandmothers are the authorities on family health in many cultures. An NGO, a non-governmental organization called the Grandmother Project, discovered that when grandmothers' traditional knowledge was augmented with just a little bit of contemporary medical information, huge change happened. When the Senegalese grandmothers learned from the community health workers that their daughters were dying in childbirth as a result of FGM, from hemorrhaging, they were shocked. It was, in fact, the grandmothers who had perpetuated this tradition. In fact, it was they who had conducted the cutting. It was so long between the cutting and the birthing that they had never made this connection until they talked to the community health workers. They sought support immediately from imams and from head men and from school principals, and they all vowed to work with the grandmothers to help end this practice. First, the grandmothers asked the villagers, whom they convened in intergenerational meetings, meeting after meeting after meeting, to talk about this. First, the grandmothers asked the villagers to identify good traditions that should be continued. People named traditional dancing and riddles and storytelling and games, proverbs. And then they invited villagers to talk about bad traditions that they could agree should be discontinued. Ultimately, 20 villages surrounding Velingara in the southeast corner of Senegal, 20 villages over a three-year period, talked and talked and talked, and ultimately every single one of them agreed to abandon the practice of FGM. By the way, they also agreed to stop the practice of child marriage and to stop encouraging teen pregnancy. Grandmothers now teach in the high schools about those issues. Hawa Baldi told me before, "We were like animals living in the forest together, but not working together." Dado Baldi said, "If I told you the importance of the grandmothers in the village, in the household, in the education of children, it would take all morning." Grandmothers are fighting for the environment in Thailand. When Tongabai Pongtawang sits at her loom, she looks out at a beautiful mountain, and she knows that on the other side of that mountain, a mining company is mining for gold. As a result, rivers are contaminated with cadmium, arsenic, lead, and manganese. When locals took blood tests, cyanide was found in 63% of the samples. Mercury and lead were found in every single one. Tongabai's grandmother group, they are weavers who grow organic cotton and dye and spin it and then weave. They voted unanimously to donate some of their profits to the people in the villages surrounding them who had lost their livelihood and their health. These women traveled from Lue province, which is in the northeast, all the way to Bangkok and spoke with officials there. They cited the Constitution, and they cited what I thought was a uniquely Buddhist argument that was based on morality, compassion, and the interconnectedness of public officials and their constituents. But the mine is still producing. I hope that children like this will live a long time to wear the jackets, the organic cotton jackets, that their grandmothers produce for them. Grandmothers are raging against political disaffection in the United States. The raging grannies don crazy hats and dowdy aprons. They write and sing witty song lyrics. They stage playful protests, all to earn media attention for the issues that they believe will be good or bad for their grandchildren. There are some 60 granny gaggles, they call them gaggles, these groups, in 5 countries. In fact, there is one in Detroit. I had documented the San Francisco Bay Area gaggle. Granny Gail still participates in protests from her disability scooter. She said 2 hip replacements. She writes their song lyrics. Ruth Robertson has a collection of really dowdy hats in her dining room and aprons that none of us would ever wear. Reminds me of the one I had to make in 8th grade. She says to people who are interested in joining at our gigs, you don't even have to be able to sing. You can just mouth the words if you're tone deaf. You don't even have to be a grandmother. All you have to be is somebody who's willing to wear a crazy hat. Everywhere when I mentioned grandchildren, the grandmother showed me pictures. Wouldn't you? I would too. Barbara Baxter Berman told me that her 10-year-old girl is a bright, shining girl. And I decided that even though raging grannies rage, they have big hearts. Indigenous grandmothers, they are praying for the earth and for peace. A shared prophecy connects many tribal people. It promises that women from the 4 directions will awaken the world. The International Council of 13 Indigenous Grandmothers, all healers and shamans, hold public meetings every 6 months. Each one conducts a ceremony in her own tradition, and they pray for the environment and they pray for peace. I interviewed and photographed them when they were in Sedona, Arizona. Jyoti, who first convened this group, told me, the grandmothers are challenging us to open our hearts with love, hope, and charity. The 13 indigenous grandmothers have prayed at St. Peter's in Rome. They have had an audience with the Dalai Lama in India. They helped to get water issues on the United Nations agenda, and they have preserved sacred sites around the world. Their commitment statement says, we believe that our ancestral ways of prayer, peacemaking, and healing will lead us and light our way through an uncertain future. Grandmothers are recapturing traditions in Peru. In many cultures, as we said before, in many cultures, it's the grandmothers who sustain traditions. In Peru, they saved one. By 1972, nobody was wearing traditional clothing in the high country, in the Andes of Peru. Traditional weaving methods had been lost. The ancestors had been betrayed. Nilakala Nyapa founded a group of grandmothers, weavers, it's called the Center for Traditional Textiles of Cusco, to bring back traditional weaving. She told me only the grandmothers knew the names of the processes, the stories of the patterns, the technical information about dyes and looms. She got local high schools to give their high school students academic credit for interviewing their grandmothers about their grandmothers weaving. And little by little, the students and the grandmothers collected enough information that they could begin teaching other people how to do traditional weaving again. So now, maybe some of you have been to the Sacred Valley of the Inca, you would find that the women and men there are wearing traditional clothing again with great pride. My last two stories are about the Stephen Lewis Foundation Grandmothers to Grandmothers campaign. It helps African grandmothers, back to the start, some of the ones whom I met, it helps African grandmothers who are raising grandchildren who've been orphaned by AIDS. The Stephen Lewis Foundation is the beneficiary of 100% of my author royalties from The Grandmother Power, the book. The foundation coordinates 240 groups of Canadian grandmothers, 8,000 grandmothers across Canada. In the past 10 years, they have raised $24 million to send in small cash infusions to groups of grandmothers in 15 African countries. To represent the 8,000 Canadian grandmothers, I photographed the grandmothers and grandothers of Barrie, Ontario. These women will do almost anything to raise money for their African sisters. They will cater weddings, they will have dinner parties, they will sell ice cream at the beach. The week I was there, the Barrie group was making crafts for a holiday Christmas gift fair. They had made teddy bears, and dolls, and sweaters, and art, and wreaths. They set up their booth, and it was swamped. Their profits exceeded their wildest dreams, so they broke into a gratitude dance. The woman in the red jacket is here. She drove from Ontario to celebrate with us tonight. Her name is Joanne O'Shea, and why don't you stand up for a minute, Joanne, please, so everybody can see you. She brought with her two members of her group, grandmothers and grandothers. A grandother is Joanne's husband, Michael O'Shea. Michael. And a grandmother member is Kathy Dunn. Be sure to talk to them later. The Stephen Lewis Foundation is starting grandmother groups in the United States. Do you know how much I would love it if the first United States grandmother group started in Traverse City? Let's do it. Okay, back to our story. Joanne was dancing a gratitude dance. By the way, if you want, she will teach you the gratitude dance before we leave tonight. So gratitude is just in the DNA of her grandmother group. She sent me off with these words. She said, "When you meet the grandmothers in South Africa, tell them what a gift they are to us. Every day," she said, "every day is Thanksgiving because of them." Finally, the grandmothers of South Africa. South Africa has the highest number of people with HIV/AIDS, almost 7 million. Grandmothers Against Poverty and AIDS, GAPA for short, Grandmothers Against Poverty and AIDS, is an NGO in Khayelitsha Township outside of Cape Town. Crimes and gangs are rampant. GAPA, which is a Stephen Lewis Foundation grantee, is run by and for grandmothers. 80% of all of the GAPA grandmothers are taking care of children who are were orphaned by AIDS. Some of them are HIV positive themselves. Another 30% take care of an additional relative who is HIV positive or has AIDS, and 15% of them are HIV positive themselves. It made me so sad to think about these women's lives that when I asked the first woman, "How are you doing?" I just braced myself. Nothing prepared me for her response, which was, "I feel strong." The GAPA grandmothers started an after-school program for the children. It's the only one in Khayelitsha. School gets out at 1 o'clock. 135 hungry kids come to their center, swarm in for lunch. They have been preparing it all morning. The children laugh and shout and climb all over the playground equipment, which they bought, by the way, with money that came from the Canadian grandmothers. The African grandmothers teach each other craft skills so that they can afford to so that they can earn enough money to feed the grandchildren. This is Rita. She learned how to make hats. She told me, "Hats were the end of poverty in my house. They call me Hats Mama." There is bread in the house. There are eggs in the fridge. I've got something in my purse. I've got power. Which brings me to the subject of grandmother power. We have a guest in the audience in addition to Joanne O'Shea and her group, whom you will meet very soon. Jackson Kaguri founded another grantee of the Stephen Lewis Foundation. It's called NYAKA, AIDS Orphan Project. Jackson works with 93 grandmother groups in Uganda. They are raising 43,000 grandchildren who have been orphaned by AIDS, 43,000. So Jackson, in a little while, will tell you more about his project. Maybe some of you met him out here. He has written not only two books for adults, but three books for children. He will sign some for you. They are fundraisers for his wonderful organization. I want to end by just talking a little bit about the International Grandmothers Movement. Do you know that there are more grandmothers in the United States today? 43 million grandmothers in the US. The average age for a first-time grandmother here is 47. Surprise. But if you think about it, if you had a baby when you were 22 and she had a baby when she was 42, when she was 22, suddenly, you're at 47, pretty easily. So those people between 47 and 64 are the boomers. They know they can change the world. They grew up in the 60s. They changed the world. Many of them here in the Northern Hemisphere have worked outside the home. It makes them particularly effective. So, as I said, they get to work. For a long time, you know, there were no grandmothers. Or grandfathers, for that matter. People died when they were 30 for millennia. So we're at a unique point in time in which there are more grandmothers everywhere, and there is in our troubled world a real need for them to work together to make things better for their grandchildren. I am hoping, my dream about this book and about this evening, is that you all, whether you're a grandmother or a grandother, I am hoping you all will be inspired to join the International Grandmothers Movement. If you go to the project website, which is www.globalgrandmotherpower, you will find a list of grandmother groups all over the country. If you go into the exhibit, and I hope you will too, you will find a list of local grandmother groups. And I'm hoping that there are about to be more. In other words, I'm hoping that all of you grandmothers or grandothers will join together to make this world a better place for grandchildren, yours and mine, and grandchildren all around the world. I am convinced that it will take all of us, working together to create hope and possibility for our world. So I thank you.
You're listening to the National Writers Series from IPR News Radio.
Thank you, Paula, very, very much. I want to bring out now Tony Demon, who's going to sit down in this chair with Paula. It's a special honor for me to do that. I'll be brief. Here he is. Tony Demon.
So tell me about your process, about the you're living. As a photographer, you're living every photographer's dream, really, with what you're doing, the places you're going, the people you're meeting. Tell me, how did it get started? I mean, what made you think that at 55 you could turn yourself into a photographer and a writer?
No kidding. I ask myself that question all the time. I had been in business for 35 years, and the last one of those years I had been teaching at Stanford a course about women in leadership. And between those two things, I was exhausted. I had been commuting all over the world. And so the next consequence was that I had a million frequent flyer miles. And because I'd been doing two jobs, I had earned 1 year of money, a free year. So I thought, I'm going to spend that one year. Doing only what I love most and want to learn next. And what I loved most was photography. My father put a camera in my hand when I was 8. And I also loved travel. And I was very interested. It was 1995, the year of the Beijing Conference, of the UN Fourth World Conference on Women. And I had heard that women were sending their children to school with the money they earned in cultures where men were given the prerogative to spend the money they earned on bicycles and beer and radios and other things. So I thought, those women are heroic. I want to meet them. Nobody was yet talking about microcredit. And I had lived my life inside of large corporations. So I thought, I want to meet those women who are starting their own businesses. I want to talk to them. And that turned out to be the first book. I visited 90 craftswomen in 12 countries using my frequent flyer miles. It took 5 years. And one day in the middle of the breadbasket of Bolivia, the sun was going down. I was standing in the back of a Toyota pickup truck, leaning on the hood of the truck, or on the cab roof, shooting as the sun went down. It was so beautiful, and I thought, I am happier than I have ever been working. I'm not going back. And my wonderful husband, who had 2 million frequent flyer miles, said, I'll give you those so you can do more books. And I am still doing books on frequent flyer miles.
So 1 year turned into 22.
1 year turned into 22. That's called the great underestimate.
And so where did you learn your photography skills? Did you just do it on your own, or did you have schooling
or
workshops?
Well, I was very much self-taught. And my father had said important things like, don't have anything in the edges of your picture. Put the person in the middle. A lot of things that we now violate. And the first book came out, I am so nearsighted that I looked at those pictures, and I had shot everybody like this. I had like 250 headshots. I could have shot them in my living room. This was not good. So I thought, I better get better. And I began taking workshops at the Santa Fe Photographic Workshops and the Maine Photographic Workshops, always with National Geographic photographers, because I thought, I don't have any time, I'm 55, I can't start at the beginning and have to learn fast. So I went to Cuba with Alex Webb, and I took a course from David Allen Harvey, and really the luminous people whose work I had admired.
Again, living the dream.
Living the
dream. Every photographer's dream, yes.
No. And I will never forget, in Cuba with Alex Webb, I set my camera so that I could shoot with a very great depth of field, so everything would be in focus all the way along the way, for those of you who are as not having different kinds of cameras. And I didn't touch those settings for 10 days. And I looked at those pictures when they came back, and I thought, who shot these? They gave me the wrong film back. It was 2001.
Because everything was in focus, or?
Everything was in focus all the way back, and I could see this huge world that I don't see
right.
when I'm looking at you.
Right.
I see you.
Right.
Because I'm so nearsighted. But it changed the way I see.
Huh. Wow. So when you go into these situations, what's your strategy to go and meet these women and photograph them?
Oh, I never go any place without having assured myself that there was a story there to find. So I do about a year's worth of research before I begin traveling. And I will have written to the nonprofit organizations and the groups and gained their agreement to be part of a book. And the first thing I do when I meet the women is show them my old books, my other books,
mm-hmm.
so that they are sure what they're getting into. They agree to be part of it. You know, many of them are illiterate. Some of them have never seen books,
wow.
much less owned them. So it's important to explain. And because mine are photographic books, they understand immediately, and they become very engaged and interested in what women are doing other places,
do you
which
show
they
them,
may never see.
Do you show them the photos as you're working, too? Or?
Not very often. I always take, the first picture I take is always a response to my question, how would you like to be photographed? They are always just stunned when I say, thank you very much, I will send you that one. But then I just keep on shooting. And usually I will have talked to them for an hour first, I will have interviewed them first. So I know that they're going to pick up their child at school, or they're going to go to the market, and I say, can I come with you?
Mm-hmm.
They think I'm just crazy. They can't imagine why I'm taking all those pictures. But it's those trips to the market and to pick up the kids that give me pictures like these.
Well, it's quite a contrast, because a lot of the words are heartbreaking and the stories are heartbreaking, but your photos are all filled with joy and love. And so it's like two different things going on within your books.
Life is complicated. There yeah. are sometimes at least two different things going on.
Right, right, right. The grandmothers that you've encountered, they have so little, many of them have so little, and yet they're so generous with the resources they do have. How do you explain that? What drives them? How do they find it within themselves?
I think if you had suddenly 12 or 15 grandchildren who were totally reliant on you, you had just buried your own children. These are heartbreaking experiences. The children are grieving. You are grieving. But after the funerals, the children run to the grandmothers. They're the only family they have. And if that many children, if even one child is relying on you, you somehow plumb your depths and do everything you possibly can to take care of them. And in Africa, it really is true that it takes a village to raise a child. So the grandmother groups all over Africa in 15 countries that get grants from the Stephen Lewis Foundation are full of grandmothers who are helping each other meet this challenge.
Joanne told a story yesterday about a woman who just, I can't remember the circumstances, but she just plopped down and she just wanted to give up. until she realized that people were counting on her, and then she just, through sheer will, got up and like, okay, I'm going to take care of you, I'm going to take care of you, I'm going to take care of you.
Yeah. These grandmothers really literally have nothing. They're too old to work. They are very, very poor. They are in a real pickle. And they know that the only people that they can count on are themselves and the other grandmothers who are also sharing this experience. The woman who started GAPA, the South African group that I talked about, told me, you know, it is really amazing what people can do to heal each other when they discover that they're not alone, that if they are themselves HIV positive, there are others who have had that experience, that others have lost children. If they talk to each other, there is a kind of group therapy that happens naturally without any particular guidance or expertise. And somehow they begin to heal themselves. It's quite remarkable.
Where the heck are the grandfathers? Why? In some of these stories, some of them are not just absent, but also, I mean, they're there and they're also perpetrating some of the negative things going on.
You're thinking about Swaziland.
Yeah.
I'll get to Swaziland in a minute. Many of the grandfathers are dead. Women do live longer than men. Sadness. But in Africa, many of the grandfathers, like many men, are so afraid of HIV/AIDS that they aren't tested. It's true of women as well. The discrimination is extraordinary. The stigma is very great. So many of the men aren't there. In the case of Swaziland, we were talking yesterday about a wonderful woman named Sipili Shlope, they say in her language. She lived in Swaziland. She was a very bright little girl who was willing to walk 9 miles a day, four and a half, and then get on a bus to go to school. But her family couldn't afford to send her. Smart, smart, sparkly girl. And she walked up the steps to the office of Save the Children, knocked on the door, and asked to talk to the director. And he said, children don't apply to us directly. He put her in touch with a Norwegian family who sponsored her not only through elementary school, but high school and university. And after she graduated from university, she had been selected to go to study agriculture at a university in the UK. In order to be allowed to go, it was necessary for her to have a physical exam. And the doctor who administered that exam discovered that she was HIV positive. And the doctors are not supposed to tell them. But he was so shocked, he knew her, and he was so amazed to discover that she was positive that he told her, and she was stunned. Stunned. She had not been with another man. Her husband had never been tested for HIV. Was never a subject of discussion. She went home and told him that she was not going to England after all. He threw her out with the children. There were five. He left. His family threw her out, actually. And it was soon after that that she discovered that other women were experiencing that same stigma. And she said, this is wrong. I'm going to start a group of HIV-positive grandmothers. By that time, she had four children and five adopted. And teach them how to take care of themselves, how to understand how AIDS is transmitted so everyone isn't quite as scared as they are, how to access antiretroviral drugs, how to protect their children from this disease, how to earn money. So I was with her groups in Swaziland, grandmothers who knew that nutrition was key in addition to ARVs, antiretroviral drugs, nutrition was key. We're planting huge community gardens, and they would bring the youngest toddlers with them, and they would be planting huge rows of corn and peas and beans, and she has done it. And I said to her, how do you who are HIV positive and being treated yourself. Find the strength and the stamina to do the work that you're doing. And she said, I don't have any options. This work has to be done. I forget that I'm HIV positive. As I watch other people get out of their sick beds and somehow become healthier again. It's a wonderful, wow. Wonderful story.
So if I want to be like you when I grow up, or if all of us want to be like you, what do we have
How
to do?
How old are
what?
You?
I'm 53, so I have two more years.
Well, get on it. You have many years.
What do you suggest for all of us to do what you're doing, to identify these things that need to be identified in life, and what should we do to make things better?
Oh, I think everybody here knows of things that they could do, even around here. I mean, you don't have to travel all over the world to make a contribution. Many of you, I'm sure from having talked to you earlier, are already engaged in volunteer activities that are very important in this city, in this region, in this state, in this country, and internationally. I know some of you have children and grandchildren who are doing that as well. I talked to someone who was going to Haiti. In fact, she bought a book. We had a wonderful conversation. I'm dying to go to Haiti. You have a son who is right now in Uganda. But you don't have to travel around the world to do good things. And I think it will take all of us, as I said, a very serious working together everywhere to make our world better for our grandchildren.
So why have you chosen the route to travel? Is there something cathartic in it for you? Is there something in your past that made you choose this path?
I feel blessed to be able to do this work. I mean, you can't imagine how much time I spend sitting on the floor of somebody's hut listening to them. I mean, how fortunate I am. When I first began this work, I thought, why would anybody talk with me? I mean, first of all, I am white, and many of the people I talk to aren't. I'm from the United States, and everybody is convinced that we have gold in the streets. So they think I have lots of money. For sure, I have a good education, and many of them are illiterate. Why would anyone tell me anything, I thought, as I was flying for the first time to Poland and then Turkey on a test shoot? And I was amazed. You know, women are not listened to in many parts of the world. Their voices are inaudible. And the fact that I had come so far just to listen to them, tell me your story, opened an unbelievable experience to me. And I felt so blessed. Why would I want to stop doing this? I'm very, very fortunate.
Yes.
So Tony?
Yes.
It's me.
Yes.
I am going to bring Jackson Kaguri on stage. I want to tell you guys about Jackson because he is amazing person, and we're so honored to have you here tonight. Jackson Kaguri grew up in a small village in Uganda, and he was a very passionate student, and that led him to study at a university in Kampala. And when he graduated, maybe even before he graduated, began working on human rights, formed a nonprofit. He ended up here in this country, studied in Colombia as a visiting scholar. And in 2001, Jackson founded, and I'm hoping I'm pronouncing it right, the Nyaka Project? Yeah? Okay. So, it operates 3 schools, a farm, a medical clinic, and 2 water systems. It supports children who have been orphaned by AIDS. With that said, please come to the stage, Jackson. I want you just to tell them about all the great stuff you're doing in Uganda with the grandmothers and the AIDS orphans.
Alia, Granny Paula, that's how I call her, asked you how many of you have a grandmother. I already had my speech, all figured out what I was going to say, then I changed it. So I'm going to tell you about my own grandmother. I grew up in a tiny village in Uganda, very tiny, you can't find it on Google Map. But in that tiny village, I was surrounded by the love of grandmothers all over the village, including my maternal grandmother, Mariza. Mariza is Martha in English. My grandmother was so special to me, so much that every time Mom fed us, after lunch, I would sneak from home and go to my grandmother's house. About a mile and a half of running quickly, because Mom is expecting you to be around the house, I would run to my grandmother's house, and as soon as I arrived, she would get up wherever she was seated, get with her stick, and walk and give me a big hug. She made me feel so special. And then she would say, come. And we'd go inside the house on this wooden made bed, and she would crunch down and reach under that bed and pull out small banana. A small banana that would not be eaten in this country, especially my children don't like those bananas with black dots on it. Those are old bananas. And she would pull it out and say, sit down. I'll sit on the floor, that floor, no worrying about the dust, and peel that banana, eat it very quickly, swallow, and run back home. It didn't matter how full I was, I looked forward to a banana from my grandmother. I felt so special, and she told me I was a special one. My grandmother had 26 grandchildren. After that banana, she made sure you walked through the back door as you ran home. And unbeknown to us, another grandchild was coming from the other door, getting a banana, walking the other side. It was a line that continuously happened every single day, and grandmother made sure none of us ever met, so that we grew up thinking, I am the special. At 46 years of age, when I think of my grandmother, I think of love, care, and a special woman. And so when I finished school and started building schools for children who are orphaned by HIV/AIDS, students and children whose parents have passed away and left them in the hands of grandmothers like my grandmother, I could not help but think the best way for them to be loved and feel special is to put them in the hands of grandmothers. Ladies and gentlemen, grandmothers in my village don't have to be related to you. I have five grandchildren and adopted. Adopted, in fact, in my village is not used. They would tell you, I have 20 grandchildren. And you go, wow, how? And then they tell you how those children are. So I knew for children who are orphaned, left behind, the only way for them to get the love, the care, the only way for them to wake up next morning and walk 10 miles to school is only if they have a grandmother in their life. And so we went throughout the village. This happened after Stephen Lewis Foundation that Paula already mentioned had invited grandmothers from our village who are raising these children, and two women got on a plane in Uganda. For the first time, they sat in a car. For the first time, they got a pair of shoes. For the first time, they got to the airport. Got in a plane These are religious women who love God, who have worshipped all their lives. One was 75. You met them. One was 65. And when they got on a plane, one of them got so tired of shoes and everything they had put her through. She took the shoes off. She got her wrap. She wrapped it all. I am at Pearson Airport in Toronto. And she had put it on her head and walked out of the plane. Made a spectacle, but made a good press pictures. When she hugged me, she told me, "My son Jackson, I've never thought of heaven. I've got in heaven today." Literally and figuratively, heaven to her is up. The plane took them in the air. What she saw in a plane and what she was seeing there was the love and care they read in the Bible, that one day people will get along regardless of gender, regardless of color. And in Toronto, surrounded by grandmothers of different races, of different economic activities, there she was, surrounded by love and happiness. So we went back home, we organized grandmothers. Grandmothers who, some of them are 35 years of age, up to 80, 90, as long as you live with children, you are part of grandmother's program at Nyaka. Ladies and gentlemen, we are now working with 7,004 grandmothers. That number has stayed the same for the last 6-7 years, and people ask me how many die and the add in more grandmothers. The waiting list to get in the grandmothers program is enormous. They are turned down to join these groups. These grandmothers form solidarity to support each other, to love and care their grandchildren instead of worrying about school fees and books. Nyaka provides that education for the children so the grandmothers can keep bananas under their beds and make their children special. For grandmothers who can't read and write, literacy writers, you will appreciate this, grandmothers are the best teachers. They tell you stories. They tell you traditions. They are the only photographs who will describe to you how your parents looked like, what they did, how they did it. They have everything in their head. And once you lose a grandmother in our culture, you have lost wisdom. You have lost your library. You have lost the bananas. But you have also lost love and kindness. So 7,000 grandmothers raising 43,000 children. Through the Stephen Lewis Foundation, we are able to build some of these grandmothers the first home ever in their lives. Some live in a tent with 10 children. Others live in grass-thatched houses. And one story I will tell you, one of these grandmothers is raising 5 children. They come to Nyaka School every day, and they come in a clean purple and white uniform. Monday through Friday, the uniform is crisp, clean. So I went and asked her, "Your roof leaks. It's the rainy season right now. How are your grandchildren keeping their uniforms clean?" And she told me, "When it rains, in the middle of the night, I grab all 5 uniforms, fold them up, sleep on top of them. Rain will drop on my back all night long so my children can go to school in a clean uniform. No social security, no retirement fund. They've never been to a salon. They have never eaten at Cherry Republic. But the love, the care, the support they give is the only reason orphans, children, grown men still feel the love. Without the grandmothers, without your work, without the support of the Stephen Lewis Foundation, without Jessica introducing me to this community right here, without all the grandmothers here who have participated, these grandmothers would still laugh, would still enjoy, but they would lose the opportunity to create memories of next generation whose parents have died, who are now at grandmother's foot. They will lose the opportunity to keep bananas for their grandchildren because they are worried how the child is going to go to school. So in fact, what Nyaka does is to be the parent so the grandmothers can continue to be grandmothers. Outside the room, you will see they are not sitting down waiting for donations only. They work hard. They make jewelry. They make baskets. I've decided to write books about these grandmothers and children so they can see themselves in the stories. When their grandchildren are reading my children's books, they say, I think they are talking about you right here. It's not a picture, exact picture, but their story is written, and because of that, their grandchildren are more curious to read something about them. And then when I go to Leland School to speak, children are now reading about students, their sisters and brothers around the world, and how they live. I was told to do 10 minutes. If you let me go, I might go for 2 hours. This is how I want to end. I want to end by telling you, as my grandmother saw my brother die of HIV/AIDS, as she saw my sister die of HIV/AIDS and started looking at great-grandchildren now, she started saying, I want to die. Why am I still here while my grandchildren are passing away? The greatest pain these grandmothers go through is the pain of seeing their children die. And then they become like sponges, sucking out everyone's pain and taking it all in so their grandchildren can smile. What you see in those photographs are years of sucking in the pain of others, giving up eating a banana so all 26 children can have a piece of banana, but giving hope and happiness to a 46-year-old man who still remembers a banana from the grandmother. Thank you very much.
That was Jackson Kaguri, founder of the Nyaka AIDS Orphan Project. Kaguri co-wrote The Price of Stones, Building a School for My Village. Earlier this hour, we heard from Paula Junturco talking with Tony Demin. Junturco's latest book is Grandmother Power, A Global Phenomenon. Learn more about the National Writers Series and upcoming events at nationalwritersseries.org and listen to past programs at interlochenpublicradio.org. For Interlochen Public Radio, I'm Linnea Melkerich.